So yeah. So basically, I would like us to continue exploring the work that you were doing last semester.
Okay.
And I'd like to, you know, first of all, get your view on this project and what you thought, now that you have gone through the entire process of, you know, thinking about the problem from one perspective and writing a report, presenting it. What do you think about the problem, the scope of the problem, the motivation of the problem, the potential for some research publication? What do you think about all of these questions?
Okay, first of all, what I was thinking is, currently when we shut down the computer, we hibernate the computer, and when the power comes up, the program can start from the state they were.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking that with binary instrumentation, we can also re-execute the program from the state they were when the power was gone. So I was trying to replace the memory of the program to a previous state. I was also trying to jump to a previous instruction location from where we can start execute the program.
That requires you to also save CPU state.
Okay, that is that I was trying for 1-2 days, and it was stuck. The program was completely stuck when I make a jump operation on a previous location.
Because the an arbitrary jump has that problem.
Yeah.
So when you say, do you know about these system calls, set jump and long jump?
Yeah, I see those after I was in this problem. Yeah.
Mm.
Set jump. It saves a jump location, and then when we when you want to jump to a previous location, we can, after we set jump, we call set jump on a location.
Right, but it's more than that, because you need to, if you want to restore the execution from starting from a certain point in time, you cannot just jump to a memory address and start executing the instructions. What you need to do is to also store the state of the CPU at that instruction, prior to that instruction. Otherwise, so let's say the instruction is move from register 1 to register 2, and copy or move from register 1 to memory. If register 1 doesn't have the right contents of that state, then you have a corrupt execution.
Okay, so by CPU, saving all the registers?
Yes, saving the state of the CPU.
Okay.
Which is all the CPU registers, which would also include the program counter.
Yeah.
So restoring the context of the CPU would automatically start the execution from the value of the program counter. That's what set jump does. It saves the state of the CPU. And long jump restores the state of the CPU. Which is why an arbitrary jump is not going to work.
Yeah, it stucks.
When you say stucks, what does that mean?
Yeah, the program halts and it doesn't progress anymore.
Mm-hmm. So you see a fault, or you see...
No, it just... does nothing.
Does
like hang.
Do you see any CPU utilization?
Sorry?
Do you see the process using CPU?
Yeah, we see that it stacks on function like Putex.
What is that?
It waits for some kind of lock and doesn't get the lock and stacks. The program does not advance in any.
Mm-hmm. It would be good to find out what's going on. Did you do any research into what's going on?
No, I'm just trying to debug the program while it stacks.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that it stacks on a function like Putex.
Did you read up on that?
Yeah, just this, that it waits for some kind of lock to occur, and when it doesn't get the lock, it waits forever.
Okay, did you do any further investigation?
No, not yet.
Okay, are you planning to, or...?
Yeah, I was planning to. That's why I asked that. Why it stacks? I just thought that if we decrease the instruction pointer to any previous location, then the program can run.
You cannot do it arbitrarily.
Yeah.
You can do it to the previous instruction or the next instruction without any significant impact, because the state of the CPU is going to be the same. But if you go to an arbitrary location, think about the instruction that you're executing next. The instruction that you're executing next could be a store. You pick some register value, store it to memory. That register value is not the same as what it needs to be if you were executing those original stream of instructions, because now you're in a different state entirely. The CPU is in a different state, right? Yeah. Does this make sense to you?
Yeah.
So an arbitrary jump is not going to work. I mean, I told you about a jump just because you cannot advance the instruction pointer by one. But so jumping to the next one is not a problem. But jumping to some arbitrary location is going to be a problem. You need context to be able to jump to some arbitrary location. What else? So you were telling me about the sleep and hibernate and restoring.
That is one another question. What's the difference with the hibernation process?
The hibernation process cannot tolerate power loss.
They cannot, but they can start executing the program from the...
If you have a successful hibernate. Think about what hibernation involves. Do you know how hibernation works?
Not in details.
Okay, what do you think it does?
I think it saves the program memory state, which we do.
Well, hibernate does that not for a single program?
No, it doesn't. It does for all the programs running in the system.
All the processes?
Yeah, all the processes.
So when you go into the operating systems class with me, you will see how picky I am about terminology. You cannot use program. You have to use process. And you cannot use a process when you're talking about a thread. Right? So, but that's okay because you've not still taken that class. So, in other words, a hibernation operation takes the state of a system that includes the state of all processes in the system. State of the OS and stores it. And the state of the processor. State of the processor as well.
State of the processor means the...
All the registers.
State of the CPU.
State of the CPU, yeah. If there are multiple CPUs, then all of them. Right? That's what a hibernate operation would do. That's a pretty heavy-duty operation.
Yeah.
If you want to do it on every memory consistency point, it's too expensive. And this is not a fine-grained operation. You cannot do a per-process hibernate. It's a system-wide operation.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
And most importantly, this hibernate operation by itself is not atomic. It's multi-step, non-atomic execution. It cannot tolerate failures.
Okay.
There's several things in sequence.
Okay. I mean, when the hibernation is going on, and at that time
you have a power failure
occurs, it doesn't do anything.
It's not that it doesn't do anything, but it can't restore the state accurately.
Okay.
Because you haven't completed the hibernation. Right?
Yeah.
So, that's if you have a really tiny nail, really tiny, a huge sledgehammer, how are you going to get the nail into the wall? It's impossible. You will destroy your hand because you need your hand and the sledgehammer will hit your hand. Right? So it's too heavy duty an operation for the purposes of providing atomic address spaces. And although we're calling it atomic address space, we need to think about all the four acid properties and how we address these four properties if we do. Atomicity is only one of them. Then there is consistency, isolation, and durability. Right? So, it's important that you think about these other properties as well. Consistency.
Okay.
Do we have consistency? Do we have isolation? Do we have durability? So I think that those are questions that you need to spend some more thought on. The other more basic question is, what are the use cases and applications for this work? So hibernation is certainly not, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't yet talked about how to restore processor state, CPU state, right? This project, in its current definition, only addresses storing and the storing of memory.
Yeah.
Is there a use case for just that? If an application were to use this capability, what would that application be, or what would such applications be, and how would they use this capability? Right, that's another question that you need to be thinking about. In the context of persistent memory, if you have memory that's persistent, how does this project provide new capabilities? If your memory is persistent, which means that whatever you're storing, I know you used a linked list approach to store all the updates. If all of those were in persistent memory, instead of writing to a file or something like that, you don't need to do any of that. But you need to ensure that the updates to that linked list are made correctly, because when you're dealing with persistent memory, you're dealing with multiple layers of processor cache. And do you know about memory fencing or memory barriers? So, thing about writing to persistent memory is that when you go through a cache, which is a write-back cache, typically in processors, for efficiency. You know what the difference between write-back and write-through caches?
Yeah. Of course.
Okay. So CPU caches are all write-back, because write-through caches require you to write to memory before responding back to the processor. Because writing to memory is very slow. So what processors do is that when they write to memory, they actually do not write to memory, they just write it to
yeah.
a very fast cache, and later on the cache lines get evicted to memory as required. But when you're writing to persistent memory, and in front of the persistent memory is a volatile cache, then you need to be very careful how you write to memory. Right? Does this make sense? Because your persistent updates to memory are not immediately persistent, because they are sitting at some in a write-back cache for a period of time before they make it out. And the other issue is that the evictions can happen out of order. So the sequence in which the processor issues the writes to memory can be different from the order in which the memory sees those writes, because the memory sees only evictions, and the evictions can be out of order. So to control the behavior, there are memory fence operations, instructions that processors provide. And these memory fence operations guarantee ordering of updates at some coarse grain. But as you can imagine, when you do a memory fence, if you do a memory fence after every write, it's too expensive, because memory fence 4 flushes, evicts the cache line out to memory. So in effect, you have a write-through cache. And maybe even worse than a write-through cache, because now you have the additional overhead of processing the fence operations. Right?
And when the fence is there, all the memory operations, because these fence are written
to memory.
Yeah, written to memory immediately.
And, so, well, operation. And any future, the most important thing is that any future memory writes, it's not, okay, depends on the processor implementation. A memory fence may not necessarily flush the entire cache. It may just mark that certain evictions cannot happen before other evictions. Because what the memory fence guarantees is that memory operations that were issued prior to the memory fence will occur, will be observed by the memory system prior to any operation that was issued to memory after the memory fence. That is the only guarantee. Memory fence does not guarantee that all the items will be flushed. All the memory writes prior to the fence would be flushed to memory. It doesn't guarantee that. What it does guarantee is that any future memory writes will not occur before all the previous memory writes have already occurred. Does this make sense? So if you have persistent memory, then you have to think about memory fencing and ordering very carefully. Because when you update a pointer in a linked list, that update or write operation may be sitting in a cache and not actually be in persistent memory.
So, can you give me any paper on memory fencing and persistent memory?
Well, a lot of the papers that on persistent memory that have been published recently all use memory fencing of some kind. One paper that I would recommend is this paper called BPFS. BPFS. If you talk to Russell or Atha, they will give you very good pointers on memory fencing, because they are using it in their project. But you can look at the BPFS work, you can look at NVHeaps.
NVHeaps.
Mm-hmm. The x86 instruction manual is the main source for what you actually need to do when it comes down to the implementation. The research papers are just using the memory fencing as a like small tool in some part of their discussion in the paper. And the x86 instruction manual, it's actually
quite readable. It's not that bad.
Yeah, I tried to read it.
You read it? For the binary instrumentation.
Yeah, for our MOOC instructions.
Yeah. So it's not, as you've seen, it's not too
complicated. It's not
cryptic.
Yeah.
It's not too cryptic is the word. You can actually read that manual. And a lot of people just, you know, on a daily basis, they refer to that manual for their work, right? It's a fairly well-written manual. All right, so these are the questions that you need to be thinking about. Where are the applications if you have persistent memory? And I would say focus on persistent memory as opposed to writing to files and all of that. What if you don't save processor state? How does the application recover? And that is something you need to give a little bit more thought. I can tell you how applications would recover, but I want you to spend time thinking about these questions. And then I want to hear what you came up with and have a brainstorming session. As opposed to me telling you what I think and that influencing or biasing your own creative process. Feel free to think out of the box. Research is all about exploration. The more out of the box you think, the more successful you will be as a researcher. So, it's very different than your undergrad work, your work in industry. It's very different than any of that. Here, it's important to question everything. Anything that I say that you don't completely understand or agree with should be immediately questioned. And that's really important. Anything that you don't completely understand as you are thinking about certain ideas, you don't simply move on. You delve deep and get to the core, because when you start doing that, that's when you start reaching the limits of your knowledge. If you stay at the surface and you try to understand a lot, you're not a researcher. You're doing one aspect of research, which is maybe a survey of literature. But a survey of literature is a necessary but very small component of the whole research process. When you start delving deeper and pushing the boundaries of what you know, get to a point where everything seems a little fuzzy and gray, you don't completely understand what's going on, that's the point that you really need to start working on. That's where your research actually starts. And that's where you're pushing the boundaries of your knowledge, you're expanding the boundaries of your knowledge, and in the process, hopefully, in many cases, also expanding the boundaries of the knowledge of the community. Because when that happens, and it's just not your knowledge that you're exploring further, but in that process, you push deep enough that you're actually pushing through the overall boundary of the community as a whole.
Okay.
Right? So if you want to see it in the diagram, I'll show you. Let's say this is the knowledge of the community. And it's a good circle because when you put the entire community together, the knowledge is more or less uniform in all dimensions, which is why it looks like a circle, right? Your knowledge. It's not a very good diagram. That's your knowledge. Okay, why does it look like this? It looks like this because this is your specialization. This direction. That direction is your specialization.
Okay.
And this is your non-specialization areas where you know a little bit. You know a little bit of everything. Maybe there are some weaknesses actually, like the theory part. That you need to work on and fill up the gaps, but you don't have to go too deep. You just need to fill in this part, and then that's good enough. Okay. Here is where your boundary lies. You see, there is a gap, right? There's this gap here. The community still knows a lot more than what you know.
Yeah.
More elaborate, since I'm drawing a picture, and this is your direction, specialization. Now you start. Let's say you're working on some specific aspect in this specialization. You need to start exploring. Okay. It's a very pinpoint that you've gotten to.
Hello.
Yes.
Very good, Hansi. How are you doing?
Sure, yeah. It's ECS building 386. It's in the main, yeah. It is in the main campus. It's right next to the red garage. Yeah? All right, thanks. Bye.
Okay, so Ravi. So this is what you're currently working on. And you got to a point where your knowledge in that specialization matched the knowledge of the community, right? Research begins here. That's where research begins. So, but when you make a small dent there, you create a new knowledge. This is what you publish about.
Yeah.
So there's a long process. First is that you had to identify a specialization, then you had to super specialize to address a specific set of questions in a specific domain, and then you had to push further to create new knowledge.
Yeah.
So keep this in mind, because you can start heading in this direction only when you start exploring deeper. If you start exploring wider, all you're doing is this. You're expanding that. Your goal should be to go in this direction as opposed to this and this direction. And this direction you need to go, but not too much. You still need some space here, right? You need to have this, otherwise you cannot go in this direction. But you don't have to accumulate all kinds of knowledge. You have to delve deeper. Delve deeper. One of the other things that I have learned in my own experience, that is very valuable, I feel, is that, let's say you reach this point. You reach this point already. Okay?
Yeah.
When you reach this point, and you reach a point where you do not know, no one knows, in fact, what comes next, what how to answer certain questions. How do I create new knowledge? You create new knowledge by constructing hypotheses. Okay, you say, okay, this is what I think. And my thought and creation of the hypothesis is based on my current knowledge. I don't randomly pick a hypothesis. A hypothesis has to be constructed with some intelligence. Okay, so you construct that hypothesis. So let me call this H1, hypothesis 1. So you construct that hypothesis. What is the next step once you have a hypothesis? Validating the hypothesis. Okay, so you validate the hypothesis can be a fairly involved task, because what you need to do is to first of all materialize a design that allows you to explore the hypothesis. So you need to create a design, and once you have a design, then you need to realize it into an implementation, then design experiments, and evaluate your implementation to see if your hypothesis actually met. Okay. So this is just a creation. You may have another hypothesis, and so on. You could have many of them. Right? All of these are possible at this point. And it's important for you to recognize this, that there can be more than one hypothesis. Because what could happen, a misstep could happen at this point, is that you could pick one hypothesis and become really attached to it. If you become too attached to a hypothesis, then you're going to try and make everything work to fit into that hypothesis. And in that process, you make too many assumptions. And then, you know, your research is not that valuable anymore, because you've just made your whole effort so narrow that very few people will actually be interested in using it or buying it, right? So, but in any case, you have to start somewhere. So you start with hypothesis one, right? In hypothesis one, you have to first create a design that will allow you to, you know, evaluate this hypothesis. When you create a design, right? A design is not a single step. It's a huge process. It's a multi-step process. And multi-step process often involves targets, right? So you get to this target, you try, and then you get to the next target, and so on. The most important thing to understand is that it's a multi-step process where every step you're getting towards the final goal of creating a new approach or design. Ideally, you want to start and go to the end point. But oftentimes, in most cases, your process will not be so clean. What will happen is that you take your starting point and you start going in a different direction. You're not going in this direction, you're going in a different direction. You get to this point, right? And okay, this point is reached, and then from this point you cannot go here, because this point has a, well, sometimes you can do this because you can get to this point from either, but in many cases this is not possible. It's just an alternate route and it's fine, many cases, what will happen is that you go to a point, and this is like a dead end. Can't go any further from here. Okay? Then you backtrack. You come here. You explore another path. It's a dead end as well. Backtrack. Explore another path. Dead end as well. And then you come back here. Okay, then you may go here. You take the next step. You reach a dead end. You see, this is a fractal image, right? There's lots of different possibilities. But the most important takeaway from this diagram is that at every step, you can be going in wrong directions. So what, in your opinion, is the most efficient process to get from here to here?
Experimenting.
It is important at every stage. At every stage, to think about quick experiments that will allow you to pursue the right direction. Quick experiments that will tell you, well, this is the most promising direction, and not this one. Because this decision point is critical. Because you might be on a wild goose chase for a long time. Just because you're tied to this idea. You're mentally attached to that direction for some reason. Right? And because you're mentally attached, you keep pursuing, and then after 1 year, you reach a dead end. This is one of the fatal flaws of many research endeavors. So it's important that when you get to some point in your thinking process that you think, okay, here's a tangible goal that I actually achieved. The next step needs to be taken. Be aware of possibilities in various dimensions. Don't get attached to one very quickly. But you need to be quick in designing experiments that will allow you identifying the right. Because if that is the most, one of the most important skills for a researcher, is how do you design these experiments that do not take a long time, quick and dirty, but they'll push you in the right path. I've seen that successful researchers are able to do this over and over again. They're able to follow exactly this process. And they're very productive. They move very fast. And they get to their target very fast because of this capability. So this is something that I impress upon whenever I can, is that ability, that openness, without getting attached to an idea, is really important. Is as soon as you find attachment, as soon as you have preference, as soon as you have some bias, you can go off on a direction and waste 1 year of your life.
Hello.
Yes. Hi, from Dr. Mathis' office.
Okay.
Just an invitation. She wanted to send out to you. I think Hansi called you.
Yes, she did.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So, all right. So, what is... you have several questions to think about.
Yeah.
I want you to think about all of this stuff and come up with a plan of what are the next steps you want to take with this project.
Okay.
And we'll meet on a Friday, January 3rd.
Friday the 3rd.
Let's meet at
10 a.m. Is that a reasonable time for you? You think you have enough time to think about about the questions?
Yeah, no problem. So one thing, you sent an email to apply India IBM.
Yes.
Do we need to apply on their official website, or we have to send email to the two persons that you mentioned in your email?
What does the flyer say?
Well, the flyer said we apply in the website.
Yes, go ahead and do that. Yes, but at the same time, send me an email.
Okay.
And I'll forward that email, or I will write to my collaborators. So you are interested in going?
Yeah, I'm interested.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. So 10 a.m., right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think for me, the most important questions that I'm looking answers for is application, motivation, for this ACID actor spaces, whether all the ACID properties are important, and do we implement them? How many of them do we implement? I think those are the most primary questions. The design and all of that is only secondary. The one of the things that that I make sure that we answer before starting on a major research project is, do we answer three questions? Is the project novel, meaning that it is new? Is it new? Which would mean that we have to do a literature survey. Is it new? Is the problem new? Or is it a new solution to an existing problem? Ideally, even the problem should be new. Because then you have two kinds of novelty. Novelty of the problem and potentially novelty of the solution as well. That you could use an existing solution to a new problem as well. That's a possibility. Is the problem non-trivial? Means that you specify the problem, but there is a trivial solution to the problem. You don't have to spend a year working on a solution to that problem. So it has to be non-trivial. Finally, most importantly, utility. Is the problem useful? I mean, is solving the problem useful? And the more the utility, the greater the attractiveness of working on the problem. So novelty, non-triviality, and utility, these are three things that need to be addressed very well before we spend any significant amount of time. Okay?
Okay. So we'll meet on January 3rd.
We'll meet on January 3rd at 10 a.m. Yep. All right.
Thank you.
Hello.
Yeah. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right.